The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Hello, and welcome to the American College of Osteopathic Internists Annual Convention and Scientific Sessions. This year's meeting was held in conjunction with the Annual Clinical Assembly of the American College of Osteopathic Surgeons. The meeting was held October 11th through 15th, 2017, and featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of interest to the practicing physician. The meeting was held at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center in National Harbor, Maryland. The program chair is Dr. Annette Karen, and the theme for this year's presentations is Goldilocks Medicine, Not Too Little, Not Too Much. Prophylactic antibiotic use in surgery, what does the data say, is presented by Dr. Mia Taramina.
All right, good morning, everyone. We've just had a short ID subsection this year. Mark, Elaine, and myself are going to go over a few things that are kind of pertinent to hospital focus and internal medicine focus in general. And, you know, one of the topics that we were asked to bring to you guys was prophylactic antibiotic use in surgery, especially sharing for the first time our conference with the surgeons. It's to try and have this open discussion. I get calls all the time with people asking me, what can I give? There's a high risk for X, Y, and Z. You know, what does the data say? And the reality is, like many other things, we fall into our patterns and what we're comfortable doing, and that doesn't necessarily make our choices correct. So just to kind of give a little overview with where the data says and what we should be doing and not doing. So the objectives for this lecture, we are going to review the current antibiotic recommendations for prophylaxis in surgical patients, and we'll talk about the most common surgeries and things that we're asked to give medications for pre-op and post-op. We're going to discuss current antibiotics available for prophylactic use as well as alternatives in allergic patients, be familiar with the continued use of antibiotics in post-surgical patients, and some recap and updates on endocarditis prophylaxis if you haven't stayed on top of that. Guidelines have changed. And some take-home points. I always want to leave you with a few things to take home and appreciate from this lecture. I have no disclosures. So starting first with some definitions. Okay, simply put, prophylaxis is administration of an antibiotic prior to contamination of previously sterile tissues or fluids. So in anticipation of going into the body in various cavities or cutting into the body, we have to give antibiotics in order to prevent these previously sterile areas. Now, the use of antibiotics for a dirty or contaminated procedure is not considered prophylaxis. That's considered an established infection. I get calls sometimes with a perforated diverticulitis, and what should I give for prophylaxis? That's an infection. An open fracture, that's another big one. An open fracture, for all intents and purposes, the bone has touched the world, and there are germs in the world. So that is a documented infection. And then presumptive therapy is when we have to give an administration of an antibiotic when there is a strong possibility of infection, when we know that there's a very strong possibility that there already is infection or we're going to be going in surgically to a contaminated space. Treatment, administration of antibiotics when infection has been established. So this is when we've got a positive culture or something along those lines. So the goals of antibiotic prophylaxis, we want to prevent surgical site infections. By far and away, that's the biggest one. Skin and soft tissue stuff, we want to prevent the opportunity to get a surgical site infection. Decrease post-op morbidity and mortality, that's sort of a given as well. Reduce the duration of stay and cost to healthcare. You know, now more than ever, we are being monitored and being there's data being collected on every day of our patient care to try and minimize these hospital stays and minimize post-op complications and things like that. We want no adverse effects. So that's a big one here. We need to make sure that an antibiotic we are giving in order to prevent an adverse outcome is not in itself creating an adverse scenario, because we're overdosing, overgiving, or giving medications that could potentially be doing more harm than good. We want to minimize consequences for the microbiome of the patient in hospital. C. diff more than ever. You know, we're antibiotics are just not smart enough to kill off the bad guys. They kill off the good guys too, and then we end up with a scenario where the patient's microbiome is essentially disrupted because of all this, and the hospital as well. Each hospital has its own microbiome and has its own antimicrobial susceptibility patterns, and each of our hospitals sees more resistance or less resistance in different organisms, and by over-giving antibiotics, we certainly can be contributing to that. We want to choose an antibiotic targeting the most likely pathogen. So we need to be on the same page with what we're aiming at here and the necessity or non-necessity of giving very broad spectrum agents. And we want to give adequate dosage and repeat the dosing if needed. This is an area where there is opportunity, where we have complications sometimes with post-op surgical infections. It may be because we had a long surgery or a complicated surgery, and we might have needed to redose that antibiotic intraoperatively, so there's an opportunity there. And then postoperatively, we want the shortest possible duration post-op course, and we'll talk a little bit about that and where there are some opportunities in our hospitals and where we're sort of overdoing it. So starting with cardiothoracic surgeries, we're gonna be most concerned about gram-positive organisms here. Staph aureus, including MRSA, coag-negative staph, and then propionibacterium also loves the chest area as well. So for coronary artery bypass grafting, cardiac device insertion, VADs, the recommendation is to give cefazolin and cefuroxime and or cefuroxime, and then alternatively we can use clindamycin or vancomycin. There's no role, and we'll talk about this a little bit later on, for just plain giving vancomycin to everyone. If your hospital has a greater than 20% incidence of surgical infections caused by MRSA, we could have some discussion here, but the reality is even if we have some previous colonization with MRSA, you're still the recommended guideline is to still use cefazolin. Thoracic surgeries, lobectomies, pneumonectomies, lung resections, thoracotomy, VATS procedures, same thing. Cefazolin, you can get into an AMP-sulbactam, and that is going to cover a little more of our gram-negative and anaerobic germs as well. And then alternatively, you can use clindamycin, vancomycin as needed. For heart-lung transplants, recommendation is cefazolin, the alternate is clindavanco. So pretty similarly targeting those most likely organisms. For GI procedures, now we're talking about gut bacteria. So E. coli, Proteus, Klebsiella, Staph strep, Enterococcus, anaerobes, they're all going to be players in this location. So for bariatric, pancreatico, a duodenectomy, anti-reflex surgeries, vagotomies, first incision recommendation, cefazolin. You can use clindamycin or vanc with an aminoglycoside or estrianam or fluoroquinolones as alternates as need be. This is where your infectious disease doctors in the hospital are happy to help. If you're not sure where to go when you have an allergy, give us a call. We're happy to help with that suggested alternate medication. For biliary tract, open procedures specifically, cefazolin, cefoxitin, ceftriaxone, or ampicillin, sulbactam. And then we have an alternate list that's quite similar. You can use clindavanc with your aminoglycosides or fluoroquinolones and just sort of mix and match to get the same coverage. This is a big one here for laparoscopic GI procedures. There is no recommended post-op prophylaxis for the vast majority of them. Okay, so that includes if you're going to be doing a colonoscopy and you're going to be doing a polypectomy, if you're going to be doing an EGD, you don't routinely need to give a post-op antibiotic, pre-op antibiotic. For high-risk procedures where there's perforation or there's a malignancy or something else that might be for a more complicated issue or a dirtier procedure, you can use cefazolin, cefotetan, ceftriaxone, ampicillin, and then the alternates, Clinda, vanc, your aminoglycosides, estrianam, fluoroquinolones, making that combination to get the same coverage. For appendectomy, cefoxitin, cefotetan, cefazolin plus metronidazole. Alternatively, clindamycin, aminoglycosides, estrianam, very similar to the previous. For small intestines and hernia repairs, the major difference here is that if there's a mesh in place, you've got to think about those gram-positives. So you might need to throw vancomycin into the mix if they have an implanted mesh or a risk for a mesh infection, because staph and strep can be hanging on there and MRSA as well. For colorectal surgeries, cefazolin plus metronidazole, you want to make sure you get that anaerobic coverage in there. Cefoxitin, ampicillin, sulbactam, ceftriaxone plus metronidazole, or in the carbapenem class if need be. Alternatively, clindamycin plus an aminoglycoside or estrianam or fluoroquinolone or metronidazole. And that will, again, try and get our gram-negatives and our anaerobes in a mix and match if we have an allergy situation. Orthopedic surgeries are another one where we get a lot of questions. This is where it seems the threshold is much lower for just throwing vancomycin at these patients. And again, that's not necessarily the recommendation. The recommendation is to give cefazolin. Certainly the alternate is clindamycin or vancomycin in allergy, but you know, we're talking about resistance and the propensity to build more resistance by giving an unnecessarily more broad spectrum agent. For urogyne, E. coli and other gram-negative rods in Enterococcus are our major players. For lower tract instrumentation, you can use a fluoroquinolone, trimethoprim-sulfa, cefazolin. Alternately, you can use an aminoglycoside with or without clindamycin. Clean without entry into the urinary tract, cefazolin. If you have a prosthetic material in place, you can use an aminoglycoside as well. Alternatively, clindamycin and vancomycin. Clean with entry into the urinary tract, cefazolin plus an aminoglycoside, fluoroquinolones, aminoglycosides with or without clindamycin as an alternate. C-section, cefazolin is very sufficient, and clindamycin plus an aminoglycoside are also a possibility as well. Hysterectomies, cefazolin, cefotetan, cefoxitin, ampicillin, sulbactam, alternatively clindamycin or vancomycin plus an aminoglycoside or estrianam or fluoroquinolone. So now we can talk about some fun stuff and the purpose of this lecture. Those slides largely were for completeness sake, and it is what I was asked to present. I know it's sort of monotonous and boring to read over every antibiotic that's recommended, but let's talk now about where some of these controversies are, where the failures of this approach can be, and where our opportunities are in order to prevent some of these issues. So, selection of antibiotics is always controversial. There's always going to be surgeons or proceduralists who argue back with the hospital protocols that they want X, Y, and Z antibiotic because of X, Y, and Z reason. And we have to kind of rely on the data and be able to educate our proceduralists with this information as to why there's a method to this madness and why we still are using ANSTEF routinely. And just because they had an ESBL, E. coli, urinary tract infection 2 years ago, and you're doing knee surgery today, we don't necessarily need to give ertapenem preoperatively. We need to kind of, you know, stick with these guidelines here. The duration of therapy post-procedure and pre-procedure, there's a couple of different issues here. You've all seen scenarios where a surgeon who has a patient who's had complicated infection issues, say recurrent UTIs or something similar, and they're going to be doing an elective procedure, say a prosthetic joint replacement, and they admit the patient 72 hours in advance of the surgery for the purposes of giving like 3 days of antibiotics pre-op. There's no data to support that, but it is done. I get calls like that all the time. I'm admitting John Smith on Friday. I'm doing surgery on him on Monday. He keeps getting UTIs, so can you give him high-dose empiric antimicrobials before surgery? And post-procedure as well. You will get a level of comfort, and we get, you know, leaned on by our proceduralist too, saying, look, it's a complicated case, a complicated guy. I want to keep these antibiotics going for quite a while post-op. And we kind of have to weigh the risks and benefits of that. Development of resistant organisms is huge. We don't want to continue to push our MICs on our MRSAs and our staph epis. We don't want to continue to have vancomycin-resistant enterococci and other issues. And the role of newer antibiotics. We have these newer antibiotic agents that come to market, and the companies push for indications like pre-op use, and that's not necessarily the case either. Failure of prophylaxis, inadequate timing of antibiotic. We're going to talk about the ideal time of the first administration, and then failure to readminister antibiotics during prolonged surgical procedures. ANSTEF, which was cefazolin, which is the antibiotic I talked most about with all of the first incisions as a recommended therapy, has a short half-life. Short half-life plus long surgery doesn't necessarily equal great outcome if we're not thinking to have that redosing done. So, and then we've got patient risk factors as well. Extremes of age, poor nutritional status, obesity, tobacco abuse, remote body site infections, immunocompromised hosts, length of hospitalization, colonization with microorganisms, patients that have colonization with ESBLs, MRSAs, other multi-drug resistant organisms. Those can all add to the risk to that patient developing post-op complications. So, with regards to MRSA, our most common resistant organism by far, 49.2% of surgical wound infections, half of all surgical wound infections are going to be due to MRSA, versus any other MSSA, other hospital-acquired germs, gram-negatives, 49.2%. There's also a concern for vancomycin-resistant staph epi, vancomycin-resistant staph aureus, and rising MICs where we get these intermediate levels. And again, some of that has to do with overzealous use of antibiotics in general. Use of vancomycin prophylaxis is not routinely recommended for any procedure, period. It's not a routine recommendation. There's no, you can take the most severe open heart, long course procedure, the agent of choice, however, when the high rate of surgical site infections greater than 20% in an institution involve MRSA or coag negative staph. So in your individual institution, if you are having a high rate of post-op complications and high rate of post-op MRSA, there could be some argument. But as a routine, as a rule, and for many of us in community hospital settings, we are not giving vancomycin as the drug of choice. So what about decolonization? Universal MRSA screening remains controversial. Most institutions, I would say, are doing it, especially before cardiothoracic procedures. But are we going to routinely screen and routinely decolonize preoperatively? There is some discussion about that. So for this, Staph aureus causes 30% of all skin and soft tissue infections in the United States. So basically, anytime you see someone with a wound or an infection on their skin and soft tissue, Staph aureus is going to be a major culprit. Colonization with Staph aureus in the nares in 1 in 4 patients, and those colonized have a 2- to 14-fold risk. So it would seem intuitive that if you're colonized in your nares, you have up to a 14 times greater risk of having a post-op complication or infection. It would seem intuitive to decolonize these patients. So the data does support use of intranasal mupirocin to decrease the risk of skin and soft tissue infections in patients colonized with Staph aureus. The most compelling data is going to be in cardiac and orthopedic patients. So we always say, and I teach my students too, you're breathing that MRSA onto your chest wound. So, I mean, there is the role for that. And then orthopedic procedures, all-cause orthopedic procedures, seem to do better with pre-op decolonization. So, in addition to the mupirocin intranasal, chlorhexidine baths. Right now, there's no specific timing of this protocol. It's sort of operator dependent. One study found that deep skin and soft tissue infections, Staph aureus, occurred in 0.9% of treated group versus 4.4% of the placebo group. So there is a marked reduction in those who undergo decolonization. Superficial skin and soft tissue infection, sort of less marked. And then the timing of the protocol, again, many surgeons have their own preferences, and they will say, John Smith, you're going to be having orthopedic surgery on Monday. That morning, please get a bottle of chlorhexidine and wash yourself from the top down. Okay. Some patients have issues with recurrent colonization or recurrent Staph aureus issues, and perhaps it's reasonable to use a chlorhexidine bath for several days leading to surgery. The classic decolonization with MRSA with mupirocin used in the nares is for twice daily for 5 days in the 5 days preceding to the surgery. But again, I have seen other folks do it differently. My preference, what do I do when I'm asked? Usually about 3 days of chlorhexidine baths, including the morning of, neck down, and then also to use the mupirocin for 5 days intranasally in the 5 days before. Many of these patients, when they have a history of MRSA, may be intermittently using chlorhexidine baths along the way as well. So dosing-wise, clinical practice guidelines for antimicrobial prophylaxis and surgery were updated in 2013. That's the most updated guidelines we're using, previously 1999. And we have several key recommendations. So the optimal time for administration of pre-op antibiotics is within 60 minutes of the first surgical incision. If you're using a pre-op antibiotic that has a much longer half-life, you should start that within 120 minutes of the first surgical incision. Updates on weight-based dosing and need for repeat dosing in prolonged procedures. If a procedure exceeds 2 half-lives of the drug, or if there's excessive blood or fluid loss in a burn patient or something along those lines, if we're losing a massive amount of blood in a trauma procedure, obviously the blood concentration of that antibiotic is going by the wayside as well. So there is a role to re-administer that antibiotic 2-3 hours into the procedure if need be. And then the other recommendation is that shortened postoperative course for continued administration of antibiotics. If a short-acting agent is used, antibiotics should be redosed if the procedure is longer than 3 hours in general. So if something becomes more complicated intraoperatively, you want to go ahead and plan on redosing that antibiotic during the time of surgery. Common short half-life agents include amsulbactam, cefoxitin, ampicillin, and cefazolin. Again, cefazolin was one of the top-line recommendations for most of our surgical procedures. Consider redosing if prolonged or excessive bleeding, or in burn patients, a lot of insensible fluid loss. If the patient has renal failure or renal insufficiency, generally we don't have to redose. They're going to hold on to that antibiotic a lot longer. Post-procedure, this is where we run into some problems too. For most procedures, continuation of therapy for 24 hours or less. So that's where we get another dose or two of the IV NSF on board, and that's what many of us are doing in our hospitals. Cardiac and cardiothoracic, you can go a little bit longer. Obviously, if you're working in a unit that has transplant and things like that, you know, all bets are off. There's no data to support the continuation of antimicrobial prophylaxis until removal of drains, catheters, and invasive lines. This is a big one. This is where we all get trapped, because everyone feels a little more comfortable if they've got drains sticking out of their belly or drains sticking out of somewhere, continuing that antibiotic for some magical period of time until that drain is removed, or the drain has been removed and now I want to do the antibiotic for 24 hours longer, things like that. Now, if you've got a perforated viscus and you're treating an intra-abdominal infection, that might be a different issue, and certainly there are exceptions to the rule. But in general, if we're having a relatively clean procedure and you've got some drains sticking out and they're on a Foley catheter and they've got a central line, we don't need to continue these broad-spectrum therapies for any non-specific reason other than our own comfort. All we're doing is breeding resistance and creating C. diff. So what about irrigating antibiotics or using topical antibiotic therapies? So there's a picture of using some antibiotic impregnated beads, which are used in orthopedic surgeries. Topical antibiotics are not usually routinely recommended to save ophthalmic procedures. There is some studies with painting the chest wall with vancomycin, gentamicin solutions. The data is limited. There's no significant benefit noted thus far, but there are some anecdotal reports, and there are some surgeons who have published individual experiences that's their preference. They do like a painting procedure of the chest wall with vancomycin and gentamicin prior to an open chest surgery with some anecdotal success. There's limited data on the use of topical irrigating and wash antibiotics in general. I mean, we certainly do it. All of our docs do it. All of our surgeons do it. Copious irrigation with these antibiotic rinses. For endocarditis prophylaxis, and this is a big one because we deal with this on a day-to-day basis, who do we prophylax and for what reasons? So, procedures with considerable risk for bacteremia increase the risk of endocarditis in some patients. So we want to prophylax patients with artificial heart valves. If you have an artificial heart valve, that does warrant prophylaxis. Patients who have had heart repairs using prosthetic materials, not coronary artery stents. Prior history of endocarditis. So any history of infective or acute or subacute bacterial endocarditis, you are going to want to continue to give these patients prophylaxis before high-risk procedures. Congenital heart defects, which are unrepaired or incompletely repaired. If you are born with a congenital heart defect that has been completely repaired and your heart is functioning well, you do not need routine prophylaxis. And heart transplant patients who have developed valvular disease. So this is someone that, into the years of recovery after their heart transplant, has now developed some issues with valvular disease. So this is not recommended for patients with pure aortic or mitral valve disease. That includes all murmurs, all stenosis. It used to be that mitral valve prolapse with regurgitation we still gave. Not anymore. It's not a recommendation. And not routinely recommended in patients with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And not recommended in patients with orthopedic implants. So if you have someone with prosthetic hips, knees, and whatnot, and they're going to have an invasive dental procedure, prophylaxis is not indicated. It is still given all the time. You are far more likely to develop an anaphylactic reaction to the antibiotic given empirically than you are to have a seeding of your joint from a dental procedure. And the complications far outweigh the benefits. So when you have a patient who for years on end, and we're not even talking about invasive dental procedures, they want an antibiotic before every cleaning, it's just not necessary. So what are those procedures? Again, dental procedures involving deep manipulations of the gums, root canals, and tooth extractions, not for routine dental cleaning, okay? And again, procedures involving the upper respiratory tract, if you're going to be going in and doing a throat procedure or draining a tonsillar abscess or biopsies in the throat of a squamous cell cancer or getting in to do an upper respiratory tract procedure, yes, you are at risk of seeding the bloodstream with microorganisms in the oropharyngeal tract, and those same patients with heart valve replacements and prior history of endocarditis should have prophylaxis. Procedures involving obvious tissue infection in the oropharynx as well. Not recommended for routine GI or GU procedures. Again, we're mostly talking about gram-positive organisms, some oral anaerobes and things like that. I'm not really at considerable risk for an E. coli endocarditis with a GU infection. So there's not routine prophylaxis recommended there. So our take-home points, in summary, the ideal timing for the first dose of antibiotics in preoperative period is within 60 minutes of the first incision. We want to consider repeat dosing at about the three-hour mark for antibiotics that have a shorter half-life. Most perioperative IV antibiotics can be discontinued within 24 hours of the procedure. There is no need to keep them going until all drains, tubes, and lines are removed as a rule. Obviously, there are exceptions to this rule, but as a rule, we do not need to keep things going for some magical reasoning here. Decolonization procedures are reasonable in patients with MRSA colonization in advance of upcoming procedures. And endocarditis prophylaxis is not routinely recommended for atrial or mitral valve disease, including all murmurs, all stenosis, in the presence of orthopedic implants, just as a rule. So that's sort of a summary of kind of the updates and antibiotic recommendations as we approach surgery. I've got a few minutes here, according to this clock ticking down, for a couple of questions, if not, and then we'll take a break and we'll have Mark Elaine up. Yes, sir. Sure. The question is about using a continuous infusion of antibiotics during surgery. It's antibiotic dependent. Based on which antibiotics, we want to get that time, that time above the kill line, time above the MIC. So there is some role for a continuous infusion to maintain so we don't get that up-down of some of these shorter half-life drugs. There is certainly some consideration to be continued on using that continuous infusion of antibiotics. We're already taking drugs like piperacillin tazobactam and cefepime and using these as long infusions as opposed to short intermittent therapy so we don't have that rise and fall above the MICs. Absolutely. Any other questions? Yes, Steve.
Comments. Povidone iodine nasal ointment has replaced bupivacaine in our orthopedic surgeries. We had a lot of trouble trying to get to find out if people were colonized with MRSA before the procedure, and this tends to get around that. The other thing that I think you were talking about, your high-risk patients, we've found commonly that patients who've had spine surgery or other surgeries where they have very obese patients, that the control of hyperglycemia has been a big issue, and they're not properly, you don't have a internist or endocrinologist who's there just prior to procedure and after the procedure to monitor that. They're called in day three or day four because they have a 200 blood sugar, and the infection rates in those patients is a significant
Absolutely.
Issue.
That's where we're seeing our biggest post-op complications as well, and the obese diabetic with a very high-risk procedure.